And so I can just be like right here.
I mean, that's that sounds amazing.
Okay, cool. Amazing.
Amazing.
Cool. Welcome back to, what do we usually do? Oh, it looks so nice outside right now. I actually just came to the office and it was like 79 degrees. It's perfect. It was really warm today, but now it's like perfect.
It looks like you're in an insane asylum right now.
I know. I kind of feel like it because it's just white walls and I'm sitting here talking to a computer alone in a giant WeWork.
Nice.
Dude, so I found my other AirPod and it works. So just to conclude the epic story from last week, if you lose AirPods when you're on a vacation that involves a lot of partying, well, maybe they ended up in your suitcase in two different pant pockets. I don't know how. I'm pretty sure one of them went through the wash. But now I have like three pairs of AirPods in my house and I'm okay with it.
Three pairs or three?
Yeah, well, three pairs. My buddy's is messed up too. So, but now I have two working pairs, and I don't know if I'm going to return these ones. I don't even know if I can. But
oh, you had replaced them already. Nice. Yeah. You can probably return them.
I can probably return them. It's like a 2-week thing. I think it's pretty close, but I don't know. Isn't kind of a power move to have like two pairs of AirPods?
No. No.
Okay. Fair enough.
Where are you going to stick like, two up your nostrils?
Yeah. I was thinking having like one for the gym and one, well, like painting them different colors maybe. Oh, too much?
Just return
them. Or not enough?
Just return them.
Okay. So we're on a bit of a schedule here. You have like adult responsibility things to do. I have to go get wings at a new place in my hood. So we are going to dive right into it. We got some things that we were going to talk about before our little hiatus. But let's go through the recent stuff first and see where we land. We were talking about Relay and Suspense this week because React 18 Alpha just came out. And that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll have more to say soon after we play more with it. I was working on my fitness app, which uses SWR for data fetching. And I was running into this problem where I had a use case for Suspense. And so what I've noticed in my apps is like, I really like this pattern of, let's kind of set the stage here a little bit. So we're talking about data fetching in React apps. I've been using GraphQL a lot. I like to use Hasura. And I really like technologies that have a smooth path from very simple, easy introductions to kind of scaling the complexity. And don't require you, if they scale, to do all that up front. And then also don't bite you if things do get complex. So I've really enjoyed, you know, like working with React State and hooks because it's just easy. And then as your parts of your app get more complex, you can introduce other things. Like when we were working on the Mirage site, we had to introduce XState. We chose to for the REPL because it was just really complicated, but we still have a ton of React State throughout the app. So I like that. With GraphQL and Hasura, it's really, really easy to use GraphQL with any data fetching library like React Query or SWR. And you just install it, use SWR, you do the query, it's typed and everything. The Hasura schema's there, you know it, it's given to you, and you just get going, and it's great. What happens is that page grows. So like I like starting in a Next app and putting my query right in the page and not making like a custom hook. Like if I'm fetching my entries for my workouts, I just want to write the query right there. Mm-hmm. And then render from data. I don't want to have to make a use entries hook in some like lib hooks folder when I start because I don't really have a need for that right away. It just feels like extra steps.
It's exactly what you said. It's forcing like complexity on you in order to deal with scale that you don't need yet. So,
right. So, and then if I start using entries all over the app and I find myself duplicating things that are annoying, then maybe I'll do that eventually, right? But at this point in how I like to build apps, that I don't have a pattern going right into it. And, you know, I mean, we could talk about all sorts of stuff now because, like, as we've been doing more React over the last, you know, year, 2 years, like we always kind of come back and have this conventions over configuration discussion, talking about Rails, because there's just so much value in that. And even though there are tools like Next that the community has kind of organized around, still a lot of questions that aren't answered, this being one of them. But in any case, I like to start with the local use SWR hook and work with that. Have my GraphQL right there. So then what happens next? I get another part of my homepage. I want to show my friends and all of their workouts for the week. So then I do another GraphQL request. So right now I have all three of them. That ends up being three. And I have the three queries written, and I'm just querying what I need for the homepage. It's really awesome because I have all users. Right now there's no like friends of friends. It's just all the users in the app. So I query all the users, get their weekly summaries. I query all of my entries and get my goals. And then I query like categories for a form or the last 2 weeks or something like that. So it's a really good use case, this particular app for GraphQL, because the homepage is just like, it's like a feed and it's like a lot of disparate data, you know? It's like the homepage of Facebook or something, which has all sorts of data. And it's not just like a list of blog posts, which is like easy to conceptualize in both GraphQL and REST. This is like lots of disparate data. It's like a query, you know? Mm-hmm. So what happens is like those three independent queries make it nice to write and author and code, but they aren't coordinated from the perspective of loading the data and then updating the UI. And so you get that waterfall problem where you, not even waterfall, actually, waterfall talks about one thing and then another and then another. These are just three independent queries going out concurrently. And so they're, because they're not coordinated, they come back at different times. And so the UI will just do that thing where it just folks like three times.
I think in one of the early suspense talks, they call this like the six loading spinners.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly. You have like a dashboard and it has six things it has to load, and you see six different loading spinners that resolve at different times.
Exactly. And that's even if you're responsible enough to put loading spinners in your components. I mean, I couldn't be bothered to do that. So it's just really white screens that pop in. Side project status. So... anyway, so you kind of want to solve this, right? Now, the first thing I did when I was hacking on it like last weekend was, what's so cool about GraphQL is you have your like user summaries query, which is like a GQL template tag string with the query. Then you have your entries query, and they're two different variables passing into used SWR twice. I literally just select it and I do like control up and it moves it right into it. So now I have one GraphQL query, which is like homepage query, and there are two sibling GraphQL queries in a single template string. And then you can just, they have little names on them. And then you just put that into SWR, you get back data. And now data.users is my user summary and data.entries is my thing. And I just made like two changes, go reload the app. Everything works. And now it's all loading in together at once. And like that, I think it's just like, I appreciate that so much because of what I've worked with in the past, but that is amazing. Like that's amazing.
Oh yeah. Well, also again, it goes to how you started this, where I just want something that like, it's easy for me to scale up. All you did was just move those two queries together. You didn't have to rewrite either query, right?
Right.
You just moved them together. Yeah.
Right. It's amazing. And I didn't have to change anything in the back end. I think it's really notable. There's nothing to do there because I think the Hasura implementation of a GraphQL server is just, it's really in the spirit of GraphQL, which is this. It's giving the front end, the whole idea when they first started talking about GraphQL years ago at conferences was like, we want to empower front end developers to build new features without relying on the back end. That's exactly what they're talking about. Front end developers can choose to re-architect their front end code in a way that makes the loading more pleasant or deprioritizes some secondary data. And you can do this. You don't have to talk to a backend engineer or do the backend code yourself and add a new endpoint, write new tests. I mean, I can't imagine all that, doing all that stuff just to change. I wouldn't do it is the answer. And the fact that it's just there and I can do it is pretty awesome. So yeah, that's just like a really kudos to the Hasura team for making something so flexible, and GraphQL obviously, but it's just, it's really cool having come from a world where we would always do a lot of bespoke backend code for what felt like you just wanted this generalized query language, you know? Mm-hmm. So then the problem is like, okay, so that works, but you kind of take back and you do like the squint test. I think like DHH and Sandy Metz have both talked about this squint test. And you know, you just look at a piece of code or a file, if you like command minus a few times and squint at it, it's like, how do you feel? How does that make you feel? That file right there. that class or that function. And it's just not feeling super great. It's like pages index, and the GraphQL stuff is like starting to take up a lot of space. And I really want, like, these components are getting complex. Like the home, the first row, the screen is like, it looks like a stories UI from Instagram. And it's like all my friends and how far their exercises are this week. And you tap on them and it shows you their summary. That thing has a modal. I mean, it's complicated, right? And then you've got like the summaries view with the form where you let you add exercises. And so that's complicated too. So right now there's some splitting up going on, but anyways, it would just be nice to be able to open the summaries component in a file, like component summary, like user summaries, and just be able to go to town. So then you do that, you move it out. But if you want the data to still be coordinated like this, and this is kind of all, this whole story is a long-winded way of leading to like the motive, one of the main motivating use cases for suspense is the parent component, which is now rendering two different components that you've refactored, the summaries and the form, the viewer. It can't let those two things fetch data because it's asynchronous. So if you want to make a UI that blocks on something asynchronous, well, React always has to render a frame. There's always a frame to be rendered. As soon as you call react-dobbin.render, you render your first frame. And from then on out, every time React state changes anywhere in the tree, there's a new frame rendered. And so when you have your app, your page component, your home component, and then it has two nested user summary, entry summary, it needs to render something for those. And they can't, there's no real way for them to tell the parent if you want to move the data loading into those components. There's no real way for them to let it know. Now, they could have some callback that says I'm ready.
Oh, you can do some wild stuff. You can do some wild stuff with like children, and but you don't want, like, that's the stuff where you open up, you know, it's going to say 6 months later, or like 4 days later, and you're just like, what did I do?
Yeah. Yes. So you could have each one of these components. You could try to generalize this pattern for your app. And every component I render has a potential to load data. And when it's not ready, I want to delegate what I render to the parent. Let's say I have an on data ready callback, right? So then you have this problem. Well, what about components that don't need data? You don't know until you render it whether they need data or not, because you have to wait for this callback. And because React has to render at every frame, as soon as it you have that curly brace and or that angle bracket and you render something, there has to be something returned. It can be null, it can be nothing, but that doesn't give you the UX you want, right?
So you've just opted into making all your components async in this situation, regardless of if they need to be or not.
Exactly. And I think at one point in like the last 5 years of the development of suspense, there was this idea that was like floating around in some form. Because it's kind of like, why do we mark functions as async in JavaScript? Why not have all functions be like async? And then if they just don't await, you just go through them, you know, and it's fine. Generator functions. Generator functions, the problem is the problem with generator functions is like they contaminate everything about them. So you can't dot next any old function. It has to be a generator, but then it's like you kind of have this contamination. So they talk about the same thing. Why not make every function a generator so it could optionally yield it out? But then you have to know ahead of time. You lose the ability to know ahead of time whether there's going to be something yielded or not. In the same way, if you have an async component, you now have to, it's like having to call a promise, even if it resolves immediately. Like you lose a lot of the static analysis that comes with knowing whether something is async or sync. And the static analysis actually buys you a lot. So
also, just to add on to that, I think having everything be async by default would be really hard if you're just putting awaits everywhere, whether you know or not. Like, it kind of reminds me of like the node callback days where like everything, you're always passing in like a callback function, error callback function, and just how like how gnarly your node code got. You know, this was before like promises were mainstream and all that.
Right.
Anyway, go ahead.
So yeah, don't quote me on, I know the async React rendering stuff was, anyways, that's like at a very high, I'm not familiar with the details, but at a very high level, that was an idea. And you can see how you could implement it yourself today. You could have callbacks and have some pattern. Every time my page component renders something, something from component/data fetcher, it looks for that or whatever. Mm-hmm. But again, it doesn't really solve the problem, definitely not in a composable way. So then you're like, well, I'm writing this component that's a user summary. I'm the programmer. And I know that I'm having a GraphQL query in here. So ahead of time, I don't actually need to wait until I render to know that. It's in my code base. So we can avoid this whole like the halting problem thing where I have to wait to render to know what I need to render, which is mm-hmm. kind of what this whole problem is about. And either like analyze, maybe you could imagine like marking all of these queries with like a comment, or like scraping your components if they have like a export, you know, data fetcher or loader or something like that. You know, you actually see some of the frameworks doing that today. Remix lets you export like a loader, which it uses in a specific way on the server, on the client. I think there's an action. It's like a static way to know ahead of time, hey, you know, we don't actually have to wait to render. And that way you can imagine being in an ancestor component. And if I imported the component and the component had a loader next to it, I can go ahead, render the loader first, or run the loader first. I mean, in React, running is rendering, right? Because it's only rendering that happens. You're always rendering at least something. So when the ancestor renders, it can first run the loader, and then you have this pattern where the ancestor gets to say, okay, while this loader is coming back, render a loading spinner, then go ahead and run the component passing in the data. So that's like another kind of way you could weasel around it. Or you could like attach a query to like as a static property to the component export. And then you could just check if like component dot, you know, if user summary dot query exists.
You have like a higher, or you have a component that takes a component. You have a component like async render my component, and then you pass in your component and it can do all this magic in there.
You pass in a loader, and then if any component is render, any of his children have a loader, you run it first, render the loader, you push into a queue of everything that's loading. You know, you can see how this starts to work. And this is all, again, the goal here is to be able to refactor this user summaries component of my app and bring along that data. Because while it was cool that I got to move that GraphQL query as a sibling to the other one in my root page, now I've lost some of the coupling, because the only reason those two queries are in one property is to avoid the 6 loading spinner problem. But the coupling is actually between this half of this variable and this half of my template, and then this half of the query and the other half of my template, if that makes sense. Dude,
there's a big trade-off you have to make in all React apps today, and that is, do I collocate my data loading with my components, or do, you know, I have a parent coordinate all the data loading?
Right.
And that's a really hard trade-off to make, because you find yourself even working on a simple app in a lot of spots where it just, both situations are really ugly.
Totally. You know, totally. And, you know, we faced this problem when we did Ember development too. You know, because we haven't even talked about transitions, but usually you want the routing layer to be aware of the data loading requirements, because that's good boundaries for your app in terms of what it needs to load in order to render. In Ember, there's an out of the box way to coordinate that with the model hook, but then you want things to not block the router transition. So then you pull the data loading parts down into components. And that actually is really nice from the co-location perspective, because a lot of times that model hook gets really complex and you don't know which parts of your controllers and templates are related to which parts of the fetching and the routes. Some people go all in on the components fetching data, but then it's not, again, coordinated, or you have these bugs where, since you're not always entering through the router and all the data isn't being loaded, you get these bugs. So then you hoist it back up again. It's exactly the same back and forth. So all that to say, the suspense stuff is among many other things that it accomplishes. It's a solution to this problem, because now there's a first class way for components to tell their parents that they're not ready to render. And it's interesting because
and the parents can control what is rendered if just one component underneath it says it's not ready.
Yeah. But it's really interesting because up to this point, like, you know, especially as we've been getting deep into React, you know, thinking in terms of like, okay, this is a new frame. What is it going to render? You know, and we were just, I mean, I was tweeting about this week. We were talking about this with the navigation and next. You call router.push to redirect, and like a lot of people's mental framework here coming from Rails or Laravel or even Ember is probably like, if I get to a point in my logic where I want to redirect an unauth user back to slash login, that's the end of the train. Like I'm getting off of the tracks and going to login. But in React, that's not true when you have a an API like router.push, because it's like, no, this is still a new frame. The only reason this code is being executed is because React is rendering a frame. So what's the return value here? And so you have to think, what is going to happen to the UI? You know, what is the UI going to be for this frame of my app? Even though I'm really wanting to just kind of like suspend, I really just want to freeze until and push a new frame on the stack. You know, it's like
I don't know if suspense lets us do that though.
Well, I'm not sure if it does or not, but my point with that analogy was more just like there's lots of little things that bite you as you do things like use effect or interact with external
anything async
where you don't actually care about rendering, or you don't want to trigger a re-render, or yeah, you want this problem where you delegate to the parent. So this is like the first time React have a way to like say, I'm going to like, suspend rendering. That's why it's called suspense. It's like, I'm not ready yet to give you the output for this part of the UI.
Mm-hmm. I like the train with the router push thing. I like the train track, exiting the track, whatever you said.
Yeah.
Because that's how you think of it. But in reality, you're
just going all the way to the end of that function.
Just because you call router push. Well, router push is in like an event handler. And you think like, okay, I'm off this page. I just pushed off this page. But
if you do it on rendering, right? Let's say you have to, you don't know until rendering whether you have auth to see it.
I think that's an effect though.
Well, okay. Well, that's not a handler.
Right.
Or is that what you meant?
That's what, I mean, effect is the same. Like,
yeah.
It's
not part of render.
Correct. It's not part of render. So therefore you don't suspend it in the way that you suspend during render.
You could have a promise that says, do I have auth for this page? Like, does a user have auth for this page? Let's see. And if not,
you know what you could do here?
Well, so that's the thing, right? The parent, sorry, we're just making things up because we don't actually know, but the parent still has to render something. So React still does need a frame. It's just that the child now has a first class way to tell its parent, I'm not ready to control my own rendering yet, you determine for me, right?
Again, we got to stay away from router push though, because it's
that's
not about rendering. I want to go back to this router push though example.
Yeah.
Just after I said let's stay away from it. You're worried about calling router.push to being off the login page, mm-hmm. but you're still on the login page because router push is async. So what you could do here is you call router push and you think you're off the login page, but you're not. Because it's async. So then immediately after that, you set some state.
Right.
And then that state during render throws a promise, which now gets you suspended.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a way for you to use.
For your example, for your to never get to a point where you're trying to render the JSX in your dashboard page with a null user or whatever.
Yeah. The login screen with a user, the dashboard without a user.
Right. Right.
So you can like basically say like, I don't have a user. Yeah, I don't have a user. I'm suspended.
Hmm. Interesting. So yeah, if anyone listening to this, by the way, has good patterns for redirects without. Yeah, I'm going to put a link to a tweet I put with a reproduction in Code Sandbox this week, because I think a lot of people run into this. I think there is an RFC in next for route guards for being able to like have a way to check status before letting someone render a page, which would be pretty cool. Cause we've needed that like in every next app, but it's surprisingly difficult to redirect someone and have, your renders be, we talked about this in the podcast, I think 2 weeks ago, but, that would be interesting if suspense is a way to solve that problem. If it helps programmers not have to worry about, I mean, it does in the sense that, One cool thing about all this is like, just going back to the vanilla data fetching stuff, which is what you'll see most of the time when you talk about suspense or read about suspense, is like, normally you get like const data equals use SWR, use query, my query, and then you have all these data question marks to see if data is there yet. And it's loading when it's empty and then it's full. With suspense, it's always full because if the query hook is written in a way that uses suspense, it can throw a promise while it's waiting. And then you basically terminate the function right away. You know, you don't have to worry about it ever being undefined. How does that work, by the way, if it's not a generator?
I think they wrap it in a, I guess it's async rendering, right? They call it async rendering. So try catch.
Throw. That's right. Throw is how you stop. That's right. Now I remember like a year or two ago when they introduced the mechanics of throwing a promise, which is not relevant for app developers day to day. You're not going to be throwing promises in your app code. People were asking, why not use generators? Because this is exactly what generators are designed to do. You can yield. And so the caller who's invoking a generator can effectively run through half of a function, get a return value, and then decide whether to keep going or not, which is still like so badass. The problem is to do that, everything has to basically be a generator. So they're infectious. They contaminate the whole stack because you don't call them the same way. And so to know whether it's a generator or not, it's like you have to always be a generator in order to have this API baked in.
I haven't read a lot about the path that React took, but they like that's off the table. Just saying like everything in React is a generator is.
I think it would just be like literally every function would be a generator, and so
it's not so bad. It's just a star.
It is just a star, but then like does it work with libraries? I think there's a good reason not to make every function
it really is
every function in your thing async and just using a wait on every single line. Then you've solved asynchronicity. It's like it's there so you can think about it. I think that was the main reason though. That's like totally impractical to like make everything a generator. But throwing is a way to use normal functions and be able to stop running them, which is actually pretty, pretty cool if you think about it as a way to bail out so that you really don't have, if you do const user, none of the code after it's going to run and you don't have to worry about it.
You can also see here why the render should be pure that's been just like, you know, beaten over our heads for the last few years is so important because if I can run half of your render function and then you call a hook that is async and throws a promise. You shouldn't have had any side effects above where I called because those side effects.
It's actually a really, really good point. Even that makes like new date, if you think about it, it's going to be different if once that data returns and now you might send a different date in or something like that. So you're, you know, that's why even like when those confusing conversations about like reading, how can reading be a side effect? Well, that, you know, you're reading from a hidden parameter.
Yeah.
An invisible input, you know.
I think this is going to be real. I think we're going to like, when does this come out? This is in React 18 that this
React 18 Alpha, I believe, was just released.
Just released. So we're going to see this soon. So it'll be interesting to see where things break. Which of our components we've written have had side effects. Yeah. I mean, we all know like the I shouldn't update document title during render.
Right.
I should put that in effect. But that's kind of like, that's an easy mode here. The easy case.
Right. So. New date is tough. You know. I mean, who doesn't do new date? I literally just wrote code today in a consulting project that uses new date. What am I supposed
I have to make a video on this, but I have a use clock hook that takes care of this for you. And so you can do that and you get the date back.
Cool.
And I did this for problems related to this.
Mm-hmm. The problem is Cypress makes it so easy to just work with the native stuff that you don't have to worry about it. Psy.clock, clock, 1999.
Yeah.
That's funny. So anyways, I'm excited. I've just been busy with work stuff, but I'm excited to carve out some time That was a 30-minute story saying I'm excited to get Suspense into my fitness app and give it a try because I think it's actually a really good use case for it. I'd like to be able to refactor that into those three different components, like my user summary, my entry summary, and then my previous week's history. Pull them separately, pull the GraphQL parts right there, be able to hack, like really focused on the summary thing, and but have the parent have this nice, you know, whatever it is going to do. They could export skeleton screens. The parent could decide to do that. But they all fade in together really nicely. One little frame or motion thing, something like that could be cool.
I think it's awesome because I haven't had, in my apps, I haven't had the need for this. I haven't had the need to, I've been able to write all my queries like in their components. In the page.
And
just
been,
in their components. And I don't have like three components being rendered that are also running three queries. I've just had a, like happy path, simple cases.
Right, right.
So I'm pretty excited to see where your thing lands.
Cool. How are you doing on time?
I'm good. I can do like 15 more minutes.
Okay, perfect. Let's go through the tweets then.
Okay. These are both yours. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but you'll have opinions.
Have to read them.
Cool. So we got like 10, 15 minutes here left. Let's go through these tweets of the week. Tweets of the week. All right, we got two. One from Guillermo Rauch. Do you like that? This yes. is let me pull this up actually because the thread is good here. So Guillermo says we're working on a solution for build time image optimization with virtually no parallelization limits. Blah blah blah. Goal: ensure you start fast. Today next build doesn't do this. Okay, today next build doesn't perform image optimization because we started out with a solution that scales for billions of images first, which is to do it at runtime. Okay, so this is like by default out of the box. I think Gatsby does the build time stuff, right?
Yep.
And then it got really slow when you add a lot of images.
To be fair here, I think they've changed it, but when we were using it, it was all at build time. We would like run a GraphQL query to optimize our image, and that was build time.
Right. Right. He says, this is very similar to how Next started with the most scalable SSR, with the most scalable server-side rendering, and then introduced static and hybrid optimizations. Running a naive optimizer at build time works for a few images, but your builds become insufferably slow, not too much later in the lifecycle of your project. that's an interesting thing, kind of like starting with scale, like kind of on this whole like pre-optimization discussion. You know, but you know, Next has been very good and they do give you really low level things. And then they've been adding higher level things. Like even the image component to begin with is like a higher level thing. And all of the hooks around, incremental static regeneration. That's like an optimization for specific pages that don't update that often to make them faster. And then there's this other tweet from our friend Gary B here, Gary Bernhardt. He says, I spent the first half of the 2010s railing against low quality, but sometimes a mess is fine. It's a difficult line to walk. It's easy to end up with an app full of not a number days ago. It's also easy to build the perfect test runner or DI framework or whatever instead of your app. So I felt, and he always is tweeting about, I mean, I think he spent like, I don't know how many months getting a static type checking from his database to his front end as he was kind of breaking ground on his new thing. And, you know, he's obviously like, I see him as a, what's the word I'm looking for? Artisan, you know, he's a craftsman. He really cares about his tools and all that stuff. So he has really strong opinions and ideas for how things should work from, I think, from a DX perspective. I think it comes through in all of his teaching. So you can see, if you follow him on Twitter, you can see it. But I thought these were two interesting tweets of talking about kind of this whole idea of like pre-optimization. And, you know, one thing I've noticed, like, as we've worked with lots of teams over the years is, like, I feel like people have either had a really bad experience with pre-optimization or a really bad experience with not enough upfront planning. I even heard, like...
Wait, can I make a comment? I feel like people have really bad experiences, and then you just look back and you say, did we do too much pre-optimization or do we do not enough? And then that's how you pick which one you hate.
Yeah. And it's all because of that. It's like one or the other.
Yeah.
I even heard, you know, like Jordan Gall is like a startup micropreneur guy who had a company and is now working on another one. And he was like just facing so many problems as he was trying to scale his company because they had like not scalable architecture built in, whatever that meant for them. And, you know, Derek Reimer has talked about that too, with like dealing with scaling Drip. And, you know, I think it was like multiple databases or whatever. And again, people who have been in those situations have ways to like avoid that up front. But then to Gary's point, you know, you can spend 6 months building a perfect test runner and then you don't have an app yet. So that's a problem too. So yeah, I just wanted to throw those out there.
I got to think more about Guillermo's. Gary's I like. I think a thing that's changed for me in like the last couple of years, probably the last like 3 years, is you need a user, right? Like the user of your application is going to tell you, you know, if NaN days ago is okay or it's not. And I think when you don't have a user, you don't have like that North Star that you're using for navigation, you end up having to make all these calls and you're just guessing. One of the reasons I'm saying this is I remember, I think it was like a year or so ago, we worked with a company and there was a power user that we were writing software for. And I remember every week she would just say like, I need this to work. This is what I need to get done this week. And you would say like, okay, like, you know, the form is going to be really ugly. And she's like, perfect. Don't care. Like, I just need to be able to input this data. And I just remembered like that was one of the most satisfying projects I worked on. And I never felt like, oh, we didn't use a good enough DI framework. So yeah.
And there's no way you could have known those things that she valued. There's no way that was it wasn't in your head.
Totally. Dude, if I'm going to build a form with all these inputs, I'm going to have it like rendered in nice modal. I want like, you know, I want to use like all those, that the combination of like Tailwind and headless UI to like build frame out motion. That form frame. Exactly. I want animations. But it was just really good to have that actual user, to be able to basically, you know, to tell me that NaN days ago was fine or it's not fine.
Right. No, I mean, I really like that you used the example that, well, Gary did, the NaN days ago, because I think a lot of people could be listening to something like what you just said and be like, no, NaN days ago was a bug. It needs to be fixed. And the reality is like all software has bugs. And most of the time they get fixed. Most of the time, if something like that was on a banking website or something, like, it would get fixed. But maybe not. I mean, maybe there's a lot of times where it's not as important. I'm sure we can all think of times and things that we in software we use that annoy us, but the company's not working on that particular thing before it releases another feature, which maybe is a mistake, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's, you know, they know what is most important next because they're in touch with their users. So anyway, the reason I said that is I think it's a good reminder that like with software, because software is soft, you know, it's not going to be done like the Golden Gate Bridge, which is like, all right, we're building the Golden Gate Bridge. It's like the optimization problem there is like build the Golden Gate Bridge subject to like minimize like cost and resource outlay and time subject to the constraint of finishing the bridge. And so like it's fixed scope, flexible deadline almost. But like that's not how software there's no software that's ever done, you know? And so because basically by its nature, software is flexible scope, there's always this trade-off that you're facing, which is why product is such a huge role on software teams.
Yeah, no software is ever done. That's great. It's like, when would it be done? Well, when no one's using it anymore?
Yeah.
you know, like seriously, that's such a good, no software's ever done. It's really good.
I mean, think about what's the oldest software, like, you know, or some of the oldest software that people use, you know, Vim, was that 40 years old? Unix, I mean, they're all still being worked on, right? They're still,
Yeah, as long as you have users.
Yeah. So as long as you have users, like the software is changing, as long as software is changing, you're making trade-offs between bugs and features. And polish and things like that, all the different aspects of it. So, yeah, just thought that was interesting. Because I think it's easy to fall into the trap of thinking that it as like a fixed document. You know, it's a there's a spec file. There's a known thing that we're building, and so if you really buy that hook, line, and sinker, that software is never done, and we're always going to be facing the trade off. Then you naturally have to ask yourself, okay, well, how can I make this trade off? Right? Like, how do you actually make the trade off? Because if you don't believe that, then you're like, there is no trade-off, but we just show that there is, because software always changes. So if there's a trade-off, like, you can make a trade-off when you buy groceries because you're spending money on it. So every time you say, am I going to buy organic this, or are we going to buy this nice soda, or we're going to go with just water, I can say that cost me $10 and I'm getting this. I'm making a trade-off there. With software, you have to have some way by which you make the trade-off. And of course, there's a million ways you could do that. But I think to your point, the best one, the one that we found works best, is having the user there. And that's going to help you very quick. Now, there's still a role, even if you know what the user wants. Maybe the user is like, I need this to be this date picker. And then I need this like extra button over here. And then you say, oh, which one's more important, the date picker? Okay. And then how much more important is it? Oh, it's like pretty more important than the second button is right next. You, as the product person, it's your job to say, okay, you go back to the engineering team. You figure out, oh, the date picker is going to take 6 months to build and the button's going to take 1 month. So now you have everything you need. You know how expensive the organic yogurt is, and you know how much money you have in your bank account, and you can weigh those the benefit and the cost. And in the same way, you estimate the value to the user. And the cost side is like how much engineering resources it's going to take. And you can actually weigh that. But if you don't have the user's understanding of the user's value, you're using something else as a proxy for that on the value side of the equation. And it's just something that is coming from your head or from the team's head. And sometimes you can do a decent job of guessing at what the value is. But really, you have to understand it's a proxy for the real thing, which is the subjective value that the software is delivering to the user. You know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't even know what I'm talking about anymore, but no. I think it makes sense, right?
To the yogurt bank account example, it's great. Like, which of these two yogurts is healthier? Like the mass produced one, or the I don't know anything about yogurt, but the organic. You know, the handcrafted organic one. It's like, okay, the organic one, but that's not, you need that's the other enough. Side. You need the bank account sufficient. To be able to make the decision on which one you should buy.
Exactly.
Really nice.
Sorry for cutting you off. I was just getting excited. Yes, you need the cost side, because it's not just about a value side of the equation. So
one sort of like, you know, cheat mode to all this is like when you're building software for yourself, because mm-hmm. when you're building software for yourself, a lot of this, you don't have to think about this because like you are the user. And so like you've just shortcutted a whole part of this equation because you're just thinking like, well, what do I want next? Well, what do I need next?
Exactly. Do I want an IPA or a lager? Like, you don't have to do a cost benefit analysis. I mean, you kind of are, in a sense of you're just choosing one or the other, but it doesn't require as much, it doesn't require anything to calculate. You just do mm-hmm. it because you are the beneficiary and you are the one who bears the cost of the work. So, yeah.
And so the NAN days ago doesn't bother you. It's like, so there will be people that read this tweet and that doesn't bother them.
Right.
And they'll just be like, yeah, it's fine if you're on this side.
Right. And right. But here's the thing, is that there's people who read that tweet and say, no, NAN days ago is wrong. It's, you've written incorrect software and it is like logically provably like bad software or buggy software. And that's fine to say that, but to say therefore it's worse, that's the value judgment right. that is not always understood. And maybe it's not worse at all. You know, I mean, you could argue that the way my app loads is a bug because it pops in and it's confusing or whatever, but it didn't bother me enough to not add my pictures, my progress pictures feature that I added. Like, that was more valuable to me. So it just gets back to the point that like the value of software is all subjective. And like, that's why when people talk about like writing provably correct programs, it's fine if we're trying to write tools that do that. We're really all over the place in this episode. It's fine if we try to do that as a way to like help people be faster. But if we do that because we are saying like, incorrect programs are automatically worse programs, then I have a problem with that.
Yes. I don't think we're all over the place. This is coming up. This is coming up nicely to our views on software. So
nice. Cool. All right. What do you say we wrap it, man? I think that was a nice and tidy little ending there.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it.
Awesome. Well, look at this 3 weeks in a row. Look at us. Just pat ourselves on the back here. I wish I had one of those things. Boop, boop, boop. Maybe I'll get some props now we have a bigger office here for my YouTube videos. I can bring my fat suit back in. I can my muscle suit, you know. I got some ideas. We'll see how it goes. But anyways, we didn't introduce ourselves at the beginning of this episode. I'm Sam.
I'm Ryan.
And this is Front End First, where apparently we talk about muscle suits. and software and this, you know what? That's it. That's all we have for today. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.